Thank you very much for allowing me to do this in English. My Finnish is very limited. I grew up in New York City, and my parents were both Hungarian. And I spoke Hungarian till I was about 5 or 6 years old. And then when I came, I learned that I was coming to Finland. I was happy to hear that Finnish and Hungarian are very similar, until I realized that they're completely not similar at all. And knowing Hungarian means knowing no Finnish whatsoever. So I am completely limited to English, and so I thank you for allowing me to do that. I will. I find travel around Finland that most people's English is better than mine anyway, and so it's not a major problem, but for some people who may have trouble switching back and forth from English, I will try to speak a little slower than usual. As I said, I grew up in New York City, and we are famous for speaking very, very quickly. And having lived now outside of New York City for 40 or more years, even I have trouble understanding when I go back there. So if I say things that are either incomprehensible or too fast, please just raise my hand and I'll do the best I can to make it slower. In the United States, when we give a talk like this, we have to give a financial disclosure. Unfortunately, nobody is paying me. I would be very happy to put the name of large pharmaceutical houses and big hospital systems here, but nobody is paying me for anything. I found an interesting artifact as I was looking to put some final slides together yesterday that I didn't notice either. You may be more familiar with this. Do you see this commonly on your internet searches? No? Well, apparently I searched for something that I shouldn't have been searching for. And this came up with Google, and I wanted to ask somebody what it meant, but maybe you haven't seen it either. What is it? I looked for something I shouldn't have looked for.
Okay, I can explain it later.
Okay, explain it later. So this is where the United States is, and that's where I live in the United States. The United States is a big country. Texas is a very large state. But when I talk to people who don't live in the United States, this is the way they look at the entire country, that there's New York on top and California on the other side, and all the rest of it is Texas. It's not like that, although Texas is quite big. This is the Texas Medical Center where I work. The Texas Medical Center has three medical schools and about 15,000 hospital beds. My office, my laboratory is right there. So just when you come by, just wave out the window, I'll see you. And then this is the city of Houston behind it. So it's not a city, but it is over 100,000 people come to work in the Texas Medical Center every day. When I put this talk, after I talked to Pekka and put this discussion together, I will just say that it's very different from the one I had, because had I given the talk, if I'd given the one that I'd planned, this is what everybody would look like after about 15 minutes. So when I went through it yesterday, I myself was very bored. So I told Pekka that I was going to change the whole thing. And I hope it's a little less boring. I'm going to talk in two different parts. One, I'm going to talk about the aspects of artificial intelligence in medicine. And then the other, I'm going to talk a little bit about my own research in areas of the cell that may serve as a substrate for a cyber-physical system. The cyber-physical systems now, as you know, are the machine-brain interfaces. and are now very, very hot. So I'm not, by the way, I should say, I'm a clinical physician, and my research area is in biology of the cell, primarily genes and gene transcription and how genes form and make proteins. So I'm not an electrical engineer, this part of AI that I talk about will be much more practical, since I know really nothing about how to make an AI system. But here's some interesting thing. This was, you may have seen this in Science a couple of weeks ago. This is an essay, was in the New York Times, I believe 2 days ago. And it talks about the 2017 competition in chess playing between two AI giants, DeepMind and AlphaZero. And the most interesting thing about this article that I found was when they describe AlphaZero's playing of chess, they use the word elegant, meaning that it's creative. And I found that to be very interesting, the description of an AI system that just does millions and millions and millions of calculations very quickly. But the chess masters that looked at it described it as elegant, as having some sort of beauty. But let's go back a lot further to the first applications of artificial intelligence in medicine. And the earliest that I could find was Edward Shortliff's, this is Edward Shortliff, Edward Shortliff's book and description of a program that he wrote called Meissen. Anybody familiar with Meissen? Yeah. Anybody program it? Don't use it anymore? Not even for teaching? Useless. Okay. Well, when I was a medical student was when Meissen first came out. And this, it ran on a PDP-10 computer, which is what this was. Just for comparison, it's a room full of mainframe to run this. And the most important thing about Meissen, it was an open loop artificial intelligence system where the inference and the artificial intelligence part about it was this inference engine. So the information, the question came this way, was processed through an inference engine, taking a knowledge base that was populated by human experts, mainly physicians, and then turning out an antibiotic advice for the use of the patient. From the point of view of what AI is now, of course, it's very simplistic, but it was the first one that I could find that functioned this well. But it had, in the original article from which this is taken, it had, I thought, a very interesting statement. Despite attention that may be paid to human engineering issues during the development of such programs, physicians seldom choose to use computers for tasks they can feel they can do themselves. And I would argue that in 45 years that has not changed. My profession has not embraced computation and artificial intelligence as a superior way of doing work. And we can have a discussion about why that is later. So let me talk a little bit about some of the problems, some of the places where I think, at least, artificial intelligence in medicine can make a defined contribution. The one is improving overall diagnosis. This is just a spectrum of the causes of death in the United States in 2004 from the Center for Disease Control. And you see heart disease and cancer being the most common causes of death. And in some form, different proportions, this is the same worldwide. The numbers are different, but it's roughly these diseases that form the basis of diagnosis. The problem is that when you go to the doctor with one of these diseases, you have a relatively strong likelihood of the diagnosis being made improperly. That is, the wrong diagnosis being made. And then, as a consequence, you have what's called iatrogenic death or iatrogenic complications. Iatrogenic meaning caused by the physician. So in the United States, again, this is CDC data. Obviously, in the elderly, there's more iatrogenic complications than in young people. But even in young people, there's a substantial amount of iatrogenic death in the United States. And in the elderly people, it's about 100 per 100,000 population. That's the equivalent of a large jet plane crashing and killing all its occupants every single day. That's just errors in diagnosis and treatment. And that's a really big problem, and it's a problem that artificial intelligence can attack. I'm trying to remember why I put this picture of the 13th Doctor Who there, but for your Doctor Who fans, maybe she wouldn't make that mistake as a Time Lord, because she could always go and fix it later on. Here's another problem that AI can take, can make a contribution. This is data from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And what it shows is a relationship between overall health outcomes and income inequality. That is, in an income inequality, the difference between the highest earners and the lowest earners in terms of income. And regardless of how these curves are plotted, they always come out the same. Finland, Norway, Sweden always come out the best with the lowest amount of income inequality. And the United States always comes out the worst, which is the highest degree of income inequality and the consequent worst health outcomes. The reason for this is much more complex than one slide. It has to do with the ethnic makeup of populations. It has to do with the life stress, access to medical care, etc. But this relationship holds up in time after time after time when it's been analyzed. Artificial intelligence, because of the ability of being able to equalize the access to medical care and diagnosis, has a potential for changing this curve. I won't say it's the only thing that can be done. It's far from the only thing that can be done. And again, it's another entire talk to discuss what this is and what we're doing about it. And I'd be happy to have that discussion with you, if you want, a little bit later. And then lastly, artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. So that even in the most sophisticated artificial intelligence system, humans have the ability to mess it up. And you can't correct for that or predict that. And whenever we use an artificial or any type of a autonomous system in the care of sick people, this maxim of artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity is important to remember. Okay. Let me switch gears a little bit and talk about artificial intelligence as a manifestation of the cyber-physical system. So the cyber-physical system, as I said, is the interaction between some sort of a sensor that in some way finds out what's going on inside the organism or on the surface of the organism, transmits it to an inference or an intelligence engine where rank choice is being made and then some kind of either a diagnosis or plan of therapy is put out. So what are the ideal biosensors? What are the ideal biosensors that we could use as an input into the cyber-physical system? Because if we don't use an ideal biosensor, either for an AI-driven system or just a plain cyber-physical system, if the inputs are worthless, obviously so will the outputs be. So it's critical to know what we're putting in. I think this is the ideal biosensor. It's a mother making an assessment of the illness of a child. When the mother makes the assessment of the illness of a child, she's taking into account many factors other than what the forehead feels like. She knows what's happened up to this moment. She knows what's happening around in the community. She knows the child. She knows how the child reacts to illness. She has experience as to what children with the same complex of signs and symptoms have done before, and she can make very accurate predictions as to what is likely to take place simply by this interaction. It's a very complex interaction. It's not merely filling the forehead. And, by the way, the toxicity of this is minimal. Toxicity of this is minimum. Other similar biosensors that can give huge amounts of information with minimal toxicity is feeling the pulse. Again, another long discussion on what you can learn from that. You can learn a lot in Western medicine from the pulse. In Asian medicine, you can learn a lot more. And in Indian medicine, you can learn a lot more. The Asian medicine canon and the Indian canon talk a lot more about the characteristics of the pulse. And it's very accurate and very useful. In fact, I use that in my own teaching in physical diagnosis in the medical school. The Western canon of medicine tends to diminish that over the last 3,000 years or so, although our predecessors in ancient Greece certainly paid a lot of attention to the pulse contour. So a lot you can learn, and that's just showing that same sort of interaction in Greece, where they paid a large amount of attention to these physical findings. Artificial intelligence is very, very important. But in terms of making a diagnosis or making an assessment of a patient, I would argue this type of intervention and this type of intervention need to be honored and respected and taught as well. And they can be supplemental to an artificial intelligence system. Then, of course, there's the information value proposition. This is unpublished data that I made up. But it's the way I look at intelligence and value. And I call it the information value proposition. On the bottom is data. Data, flat data, has in itself no value and no intelligence. It just is. It's a collection of numbers on a spreadsheet. It's a collection of observations. But it really has no intrinsic value. You add some information to it, and all of a sudden you have it. It becomes a little bit more intelligent and a little more valuable. Add knowledge to it, which is what a knowledge engine does, immediately, substantially more intelligent and more value. You make some judgment into it, which is very, very difficult to do. Then it becomes very intelligent and very valued. And I would argue that if you add a little bit more intelligent, you can add a substantial more value, and that's become professional judgment. That is specialized judgment or professional judgment. Somebody who knows a field in more depth than others might. And then lastly, there's the internet, which is stupid and has no value in and of itself. Back to what the biosensor is in a large generic way, in a schematic way. A biosensor takes some sort of an analyte, some sort of an input. So it can be a biological input, it can be an environmental input. We have a project that we're just doing now, creating biosensors on semi-autonomous drones for environmental sampling to correlate with ground-based respiratory disease. I live in a very industrial area where there's a lot of air pollution because there's a lot of chemical factories. And therefore, there's a lot of children who have asthma. And most of the children who have asthma are low-income children because they live closer to the chemical factories. And so now we've developed a way that we can warn children that they're likely to be subjected to a pollution event by measuring the volatile organic compounds in the pollution column and measuring that and tracking it using semi-autonomous drones. I looked for the picture of it because it's very cool to watch these drones flying around and mapping the plume, but it would be A, irrelevant to this talk, and B, I couldn't find it. But the principles of a biosensor are pretty much the same. There's some kind of an analyte that's floating around. In our case, we were using volatile organic compounds in the air. They're bound to some kind of a biological component that sets up some kind of a reaction, which is amplified, processed, and then displayed. So there's the sensor component and the physical component. Pretty much all biosensors are the same in this way. they can go a little bit too far. You can have people who have gotten enamored with biosensors and coat themselves with it. I don't know if you've experienced the quantified self in Finland. Have you experienced that yet? The movement for the quantified self? Well, that's what it is. It's people walking around measuring every physiologic parameter that they can in real time, graphing it, putting it on Twitter, putting it on Facebook, and sharing it with a great amount of universe of people who are completely uninterested. That's the quantified self. There's a big movement about that. So, moving from there, what feature of a cell, so a component of a body, could serve as an input for a cyber-physical system, and would we be able to measure several parameters about a body at once without loading ourselves up with biosensors, like our friend in the previous picture? So the answer to that, of course, is yes. This is the standard view of a biosensor, and biosensor sensor component complete. And so let's just take, we want to do multiple readings on a person at home. Let's just say blood pressure. We know from years of experience that the blood pressure that's measured in a clinician's office is very different from the blood pressure that is actually occurring to the person during most of the day. This is accepted. So if you check your blood pressure, if you have people check their blood pressure at home, before breakfast, before their first cup of coffee, when they get out of bed, in a basal condition, sitting down, in the left arm, elevated, in a quiet room, that blood pressure will be very, very different from the one that's obtained in the clinician's office. And very often, we make treatment decisions based on the blood pressure that we measure in the office. You go into the physician's office, the nurse or the physician checks the blood pressure, it's high, somebody says you have high blood pressure, here, take these pills. One third of the diagnoses of hypertension, of high blood pressure, are inaccurate as a consequence of that. Meaning that we're treating one third of the people inappropriately. We're treating them with medicine for high blood pressure, when indeed what they have is an exaggerated response to the fear or anxiety of being in a physician's office, the so-called fight or flight reflex. The fight or flight reflex is a very primitive reflex that exists in our brain, and it was designed for us to be able to escape saber-toothed tigers 20,000 years ago. So we're going out in the field and we're going hunting and this big tiger comes at us. What do we have to do? We have to be able to run. We have to be able to breathe quickly. We have to be able to have blood circulation to our legs to allow us to move. Blood circulation to our heart to allow it to use oxygen well. We have to constrict the pupils of the eye so we can see long distances. All those things are the autonomic nervous systems, and they all cause blood pressure elevation. The only problem is there are no saber-toothed tigers anymore. Otherwise, it would be a perfectly useful reflex to still have. But because it's still around, I, as the physician, am perceived as the saber-toothed tiger by the person sitting in the chair. There's an anxiety reaction, blood pressure goes up. So we've got to find some way to get around that. And one of the ways is to do it at home, in the way I just described. Similarly, heart rate, lung function, body temperature are all the same. Weight tends to change less. We now, and I can talk about this a little bit, and I will talk about it a little bit in terms of the circadian cycle. We now know that if you really want to know accurate blood pressure, you monitor blood pressure throughout the day. And there are monitors available. We're just beginning to get them available. They've been available in Spain for a decade. In fact, in Spain, it's the standard of care for measuring blood pressure. And it's a cuff that goes to a little monitor, telephone-sized, a telephone-sized monitor that you wear on your belt. And every 20 minutes, it checks your blood pressure. and it does it while you're awake and while you're asleep, and you get a pattern of blood pressure through the day. And almost everybody who doesn't have elevated blood pressure, at night their blood pressure dips. It dips low. So you have blood pressure, then it dips at night, and then it comes back early in the morning just before you awaken. That's normal. That's a normal blood pressure. And it helps distinguish normal from pathological blood pressure. The only difference is you got to be able to measure blood pressure at night, meaning you need to have some kind of a system like that. Otherwise, you're running the risk of diagnosing blood pressure inaccurately in a third of the people, giving them medicines that are going to make them feel terrible at best and make them sick at worst. So anyway, all these data can go together into some kind of a home device that can go versus what one of our senators in the United States called the interweb machine. Goes through the interweb machine into a data server and then can be reviewed by a clinician. So this has been around, this sort of notion has been around for a while. This article was published already 15 years ago. And it's been known how to do it. I'd like to describe for you two different types of cyber-physical systems. One's called an open loop and the other one's a closed loop system. An open loop, very simply, is a set of biosensors that work through some kind of a processing mechanism and provide information to somebody, a clinician or somebody who cares about that. That's open loop. And then this person has to activate something to make a difference back to the end user. So that's an open loop cyber-physical system. There's, on the other hand, a closed loop cyber-physical system. I forgot this thing works now. Yeah, this thing works. I don't know why I keep walking back and forth. Sorry. Closed-loop biosystem, which is the classic insulin pump. You may be familiar with this device. This is a classic artificial intelligence device that is in widespread use clinically. As you know, there are people who are type 1 diabetics who don't make insulin on their own, who without the presence of insulin would go into diabetic ketoacidosis coma and die. And before 1921, that's exactly what everybody did. In 1921, two Canadian physicians, well, one scientist, one physician, he actually wasn't a physician, he was a medical student, named Banting and Best, pancreatectomized a dog and replaced all the insulin functions of this dog by exogenous insulin, and thereby earned themselves a Nobel Prize. But people needed to check blood sugar, usually by doing a finger stick, blood sugar at least over the last 40 years. Prior to that, checking blood glucose in urine. So checking a finger stick for blood sugar, monitoring it, making a decision about insulin dose, and then administering the insulin, injectable insulin. There's no reasonable oral form of insulin, so it has to be injected. A big deal. And people who are brittle, who have brittle diabetes, were having to do this 3 and 4 times a day. So a lot of inconvenience and very difficult and expense. So along comes a clever group of people and they find out that there's a corollary between the sugar in the blood and the sugar in the what's called the interstitial fluid, the fluid between the skin and the fat layer. And they create this, They created this biosensor, which is here. It has to be changed out every 3 days, and it's a very compact sensor which measures sugar in the interstitial fluid, which has a reasonable correlate with blood sugar, and sends it to a phone. Some sort of receiving device, but it can be a phone, where they can map their own blood sugar. And then this guy here is an insulin pump, gets this signal from here directly, so you can see it yourself, but the pump itself gets a signal from this guy here and delivers you a continuous amount of insulin to match the amount of sugar. So you go have a nice, rich, finished breakfast, and your blood sugar spikes nice and high. This guy will set out extra insulin, and then you decide you're going to, for atonement, you're going to go out and do a 10-kilometer run, and your blood sugar goes down, this guy can slow down the blood sugar. And if you know that you're going to go to the movies and eat a box of candy, you can push this button here and you can get an extra dose of insulin to cover it. So this is a closed-loop cyber-physical system with a biosensor. All right, classic symptom. And you can see there's a lot of cleverness built into that system. Okay, so I wanted to put these things together, but I wanted to add, just for your consideration, when you're out constructing open and closed loops, artificial intelligence-based cyber-physical systems, I wanted to bring to your attention one other interesting part that really makes these things work, which is, here's your sort of typical biosensor, transmission, platform, and storage, somebody doing analytics. But what I put here differently is community health intervention. Most of what we treat in terms of chronic disease in our developed economies are a relationship between the community, that is, the diet available, the exercise opportunities, air pollution, many other things that have a direct impact on the disease or condition that we're trying to manage. So I would argue that in order for any of these things to work well, this sort of community health intervention is required for success. But there has to be real-time decisioning at the point of care, and these are the criteria that I use for assessing a cyber-physical system with community intervention as to whether it has a prayer of working. So, cost. So, low-cost implementation, early detection. If the condition, let's say your blood sugar is elevated and you don't detect it for 6 hours, it can become much, much more elevated and much more difficult to treat. So early detection is important. It's going to have it, and it's going to be obviously innovative. And most importantly, it has to in some way honor the fact that the individual is not a research subject but has some degree of autonomy having to do with this. I'm just going to show you this for fun and games. You may have seen this before. This is how far artificial intelligence can go. This was done by a friend of mine at the University of Minnesota several years ago. And you'll see the drone flying. See that drone flying around? And that's pretty neat. But the entire, that's the sensor, the drone flying, and that's where it's controlling it. There's a guy sitting there with a helmet. And this is, see, this guy is controlling the drone entirely with brainwaves. You may have all seen this many times before, but this this exists now. This film was made a couple of years ago, so the sky's the limit there. So let me finish up in the last few minutes by talking about the cell and what the cell can give us in terms of inputs into artificial intelligence-based cyber-physical systems. We'll see if this works. Biology is very, very complex. That's a simple statement, straightforward, nobody will argue with me. And we can measure different parts of biology. The phenome, or the phenotype, is what we all look like. When we look at each other, we're looking at the phenotype. Yeah. Below that is the action of the cell, the metabolic action of the cell, production of proteins, which we call the metabolome. Below that is the proteome, which are proteins that make the metabolome. Below that is the transcriptome, which is the product of gene action. And below that is the genome. you hear a lot of talk, and this, by the way, this is very, very simplistic, because I didn't talk about epigenetics and how the environment can write itself upon the gene. It's a long and more complex discussion. If anybody wants to get into that discussion, I'll be happy to have it with them, because that is one of the foci of my research, my lab's research area. But the reason I show you this is a couple things. One is so that you realize that what you see is not what's in what you get, right? So this, the phenotype, what's on the surface, is a reflection of this massive amount of the iceberg that is below the surface. The second thing is that if you send your saliva out to one of these companies to get your genes sequenced, all you learn, the 23andMe, and they're all over the world now, and mainly what they'll tell you is that you're, you know, two-thirds Boxer and one-third Malamute. They don't tell you all that much, as much as you think they promise, but the what they're doing is they're looking at this. This simple, basic part of the genetic elements. They're not measuring any of these things which have to do with the amazing amount of variability. Just look around this room. If you just look around this room, we all have the same chromosome complement. Every single one of us in this room has the same chromosome complement. And in fact, there's a 98.8% homology between us and mice. Okay, so almost all of what we have in terms of our genetic complement is identical to that of mice. And even when you get down to worms like C. elegans that have small amount, 93 cells, there's still enough homology that we can use them to study genetic diseases of humans. So understanding the gene means you understand the gene. And in order to be able to understand contribution to disease, you have to be able to understand this. So how do you do that? One of the ways you can do it is to resolve that biological complexity. And I won't go through, obviously, all the details, but each one of these things has a different technology that is able to do the sequencing. So all the way from doing macro studies like gene knockouts, we can get down into the into the very sophisticated areas of how coactivators bind to chromatin, how they can bind to the actual way that the DNA is folded. And we can measure all that stuff, and we can measure it with high degree of accuracy. So we start to begin to get a picture of this entire vertical. It's complex and really expensive. And then lastly, that stuff can all be integrated, and we do that by way of computational biology, which is probably an area that you're a little bit more familiar with. It can be taken to a ridiculous extent. This is a paper that was published by Michael Snyder a couple of years ago in Cell. Personal omics profiling reveals dynamic molecular and medical phenotypes. What Michael did is he spent $1.3 million. And he did all that stuff that I showed you on the other slide to a human subject, who, by the way, was himself. And he did this and published this incredible array of genetic and biological insight into himself. And I'll have to say that the major impact that he was able to do was predict by findings that 3 days from hence, he will develop a respiratory infection, a common cold. And so that was the major, and that he had a familial predilection to diabetes, which he could have found out by asking his mother, who was a diabetic. So many of us have argued that this was very adventuresome, but it was done merely because there was a man who had a little bit of extra money laying around and thought he could do it, and he did do it. Many of us have called this now the Narcissome, playing off the fact of Narcissus, the goddess who looked at herself. Not a lot of enthusiasm for doing that in the community. Let me spend a moment before I close on talking about circadian rhythms. That is, these cycles which determine sleep and wake cycles. The reason I bring up circadian rhythms is because they have very dramatic expressions, not only in terms of the chemical makeup of the body, but also phenotypic, that is, things that you can observe. And these cell oscillations, of which the circadian oscillation is but one, are very attractive substrates for cyberphysical system inputs. So the typical circadian cycle, you've seen this before. You begin, your lowest body temperature is at 4:30 in the morning. You have a sharp rise in blood pressure to get you out of bed here. Your most alert condition is around midday. Around the beginning of the afternoon, you sort of have to have a fade. You put your feet up on the desk. You close the door. You start to think pretty thoughts about going ice skating. Get 15 or 20 minutes of rest, and then you're good for the rest of the afternoon. And then eventually your melatonin secretion starts roughly about supper time, and you begin to get ready for sleep and go do this, and then continue to do this over and over and over again. This is controlled by a simple but very sophisticated loop in the body that is activated by sunlight. Sunlight activates the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is an area behind the brain, behind the eyes, rather, suprachiasmatic nucleus. And it activates, I won't, again, go through all this, but it activates a complex of 12 genes that are in every cell of the body, and they feed back upon each other and cause this oscillatory signal. And indeed, every single one of these components has been worked out. These have all been cloned, and these all have been knocked out in animals. So we know exactly what each component of these does and which each one contributes to it. Here's an experiment that we performed in our lab. It was reported a couple of years ago. What we did is we took mice. So this is the vertical lines are activity. Mice, when they're in a cage, spend most of their day running on a wheel. They very much like to do this. If they're given a choice of running on the wheel or not, they will run on the wheel. And so it's entertaining for mice, but it's also a very good indicator that the mouse is active. Mice are nocturnal, so they sleep during the day. So you see here the lights are on, mice are asleep, lights go off, mice go on the wheel. And they eat during this time as well. What you see is now we put them in constant darkness, we turn the lights off completely, and for many days they maintain this same pattern, even though there is no light stimulus. The reason for that is that there is a clock in each cell of the body. So there's the master clock, which is in the suprachiasmatic nucleus behind the brain, but there is a clock in each cell of the body. And that clock is independent of sunlight. So it just keeps doing its thing. And this is kind of interesting because if we knock out, this is one single coactivator called steroid receptor coactivator 2. If we knock this out, that is, we make it not functioning in the mouse, we completely distort their ability to entrain in day-night cycle. And there are some many intriguing aspects about this having to do with human disease. But you can see that it's really very delicate. This is one single coactivator. We don't do anything with genes. We don't do anything with transcription factors. All we're doing is knocking out this one coactivator. Now, in our lab, we were speculating... I'm going to skip this. We were speculating that there were many clocks within the cell, not just one. And indeed, we found a dominant 12-hour mammalian clock, which is present in every cell in the body. and is completely independent of the circadian cycle. So within your body right now, you have a 12-hour clock that is functioning and doing very well, independent of circadian cycle. And this is just in here to remind me to tell you about it, not to explain the cell biology. Don't get scared. But what we wanted to show you, this just proves, and I can walk you through it how, but this just proves that this is independent of, BMAL is the major gene of controlling the circadian clock. So when we knock out BMAL, you can see that, well, you can't see, but you take my word for it, that the function of this cassette of genes works exactly the same regardless of whether the circadian cycle is there. Now, why is that? Why does that turn out to be important? Well, it has a couple of interesting mathematic characteristics. One is that most of the raw data looks kind of gemishy like this. It's kind of scattergrammy. And in order for us to get at these data and make them usable as a signal, we have to deconvolute them. And the deconvolution of these data has been very difficult over the years. Our big discovery a couple of years ago was that we could look at these gene transcription data, that is, products of genes, RNA, as a signal rather than as an isolated protein, measure them over time, and then deconvolute them using signal processing mathematics. And so what we devolved upon is we developed a method by which we take the eigenvalue and use the eigenvalue as a method of deconvolution and put it into a matrix. And we can derive from that what the actual oscillation is. We can then perturb it with a whole number of things. And this is just using MYC, which is a very common protein that causes a lot of cancers. And what we can show, we've been able to show, is that in these by using these oscillations as measures, if we deregulate MYC, that is, we make MYC active, we can do a large number of bad things to the cell, which reflect themselves in these oscillations. And these are oscillations that we can measure. So all of a sudden, we're looking at things that will give us indicators of decompensation in the human body, which could be considerably bad, only based on the oscillations in gene products. Now, there are other ways of doing it. You're all familiar with the MeliFind and various other spatial mapping software that look at the skin and attempt to differentiate a black lesion like this, this is an obvious malignant melanoma, try to differentiate this from a melanocytic nevus, which can look similar, it'll never look this angry, but it can look similar, but is non-malignant. And there are many, many spatial mapping ways of doing that. One of the things that we've done in the lab is we exploited the ability of different wavelengths of light to penetrate differently through the skin. And this is just an example. This is an example of blue light, where you can see superficial characteristics. This is yellow light, where you begin to see characteristics sort of in the middle of the lesion. And then this is red light, where you see only the base of the lesion. And so we can actually put this thing together mathematically, and we can create a three-dimensional view of the lesion. And each of these cancers have specific signatures, and we can do this non-invasively. And just as an example of how phenotype can be reflected into sensors as a basis for artificial intelligence and diagnosis. Now, we have a problem in the world. When I came to Finland for the first time a couple days ago, and I'd unfortunately never been here before, I was struck by one thing, which is that people are generally lean. And when I found myself comparing it, if you were to walk into Houston, Texas, and get off the airport, you would be quite surprised at looking at the phenotype of people. People are large. People are large. And this is a big problem, not only in Texas, but in the United States, is we have people who've become large and are not able to compensate metabolically for the size of their bodies. As a consequence, we have a large number in the United States, and now you're starting to see this worldwide, of chronic diseases. And it's chronic diseases, chronic non-communicable diseases, are things like diabetes, cancer, heart disease, stroke, and inflammatory diseases. And what you see here in the United States, it's expected that there will be about a 50% increase in these chronic diseases, but more importantly, a substantial number of people have more than one. And these are diseases that cannot be managed by a physician. They are managed, can be only managed by a person who has the illness in collaboration with the person who has some knowledge. And it requires monitoring, and it requires feedback loops, and it requires an assessment of what's going on in the body. And I argue that that can only be done by a rigorous artificial intelligence system that's coupled with a cyber physical system. Now, obviously, what we're all looking for is tricorder. Are you familiar with this device from Star Trek? You may have seen it. This is a first-generation tricorder. Notice the doctor here applies it to the victim. And the nice thing about the tricorder is it not only makes the diagnosis, but it administers the therapy. This is a third-generation tricorder, and we don't have anything like that. But I will say that we are beginning to get there. And just very briefly, these are conditions that have molecular representations, that have surface observations, and that have monitors that are easily obtained, some of whom, this one and this one, were built in my lab, but they can easily be built. None of them are patented. I can tell you how to do it in a half an hour. It's very easy. But all these things can measure significant amount of medical illnesses that, if the person knew about it, would be able to make a change that would be salutary for their life. And just keep going on. There are many others. This is not from my lab. This is the MeliFind. I like to use this one because it's a little simpler and a little cheaper. And it's not patented. But there are many ways that you go by simply assessing the capillaries that you see underneath the fingernails. You can make some very aggressive statements about the state of blood vasculature. And here's just a table to show you how to confuse it. It's pretty much the same thing. Here are the sources of materials that you can use, the pathways that you can identify, the molecular pathways that you can identify, and the illnesses that would be susceptible to diagnosis and treatment simply by combining all these things. So we're clearly not looking for that. If I hope I didn't leave you with the idea that I'm hoping that somehow I will be able to automate myself out of my profession. I think there are things that require the interaction between a caring person and a person needing care. And I hope that will not change. But what I do hope will change is that we'll be able to get some sensory information and do it in an automated way and bypass some of the many routine tasks that are done by medicine. And I think that's a reasonable goal for cyber-physical systems combined with artificial intelligence. Briefly, here is my group of cherished collaborators. In the O'Malley Laboratory, we have three major people working. We work closely with the Westbrook Laboratory in MYC oncogenes. We work with Chang Zhang at Rice in algorithm development. Bo Kai Zhu is the fellow who did the earlier work on the 12-hour cycle. Yaakov Ben-Haim at the Technion does severe uncertainty and has helped us understand the role of optimization in clinical measurements. And then Thanos Antoulis is at the Max Planck Institute in Magdeburg, and he works primarily on understanding eigenvalues and eigenvalue pencils, and has been extremely useful and has been a great collaborator. And this is our major source of funding. So to Pekka, Palyon Kitkosia.
Palyon
Kitkosia. And the next one, how's that? Kitos Istavani. How's that? Not so good? Kismixia? Questions, comments?
Please.
Ma'am. See if I,
can you repeat the question because we
yeah,
are recording?
Yeah, let me see if I understand. You want to go back a couple of slides. Was it
this one,
okay, sure. Sure, I can walk through this very quickly. So in skeletal myopathies are commonly mitochondrial diseases. And the mitochondria is the furnace of the cell. It's where energy is produced, where ATP is created for the most part. When it fails, it does not convert sugar into ATP, but it shunts the pathway into the production of pyruvate and subsequently into lactic acid. And lactic acid causes decrease in the pH in the blood. Very similar to very easy to measure. In gluconeogenic precursors, particularly in some inherited diseases of glucose metabolism, people don't metabolize glucose. Their exercise structures are very limited, and they have decreases in oxygenated hemoglobin. Very simple to measure by something as simple as a pulse oximeter. In patients with congestive heart failure, their heart is not able to meet the metabolic demands of the exercising heart. So they get short of breath and weak. And when that happens, a number of physiologic findings follow that. One is that their pulses become long. So instead of having a nice brisk pulse like that, you end up with pulses like that because the heart squeezes like that instead of squeezing like that. You can measure that again with a pulse oximeter. The other thing is that you have activation of the autonomic nervous system, which means that the normal respiratory variation that is seen in the cardiac cycle is under the influence of the autonomic nervous system and becomes very regular. So the normal respiratory variation goes away and the heartbeat becomes regular. People gain weight and they retain water. So you can measure water through impedance, through running a low electrical current through the body and measure impedance. And if you take impedance, pulse contour, and beat-to-beat variation in the heart, and you roll it up into an equation, it tracks cardiac output as measured by echocardiogram very easily and very quickly. Arrhythmia and EKG is very simple. It equals. Age-related macular degeneration requires long-term retinal monitoring, but that can be done very easily with algorithms that recognize changes in the fundus with devices like this, which connect to a phone and do a non-dilated image of the retina, which can be easily done at home. There's another picture. Yeah. I'm very fond of detecting capillary loops underneath the fingernails. And if you just do very simple very simple magnification with no dye whatsoever, you can see these capillary loops, and they're underneath the fingernail in the area very close to where the origin of the fingernail is. And there are very many different patterns, as you can see. There are different patterns that show different types of diseases of the blood vessel that are very easy to observe. And then we talked a little bit about pigmented lesions that can be seen in spatial reconstruction of skin lesions, or as I showed you in a visual tomography. Is that okay?
Yes.
You okay there? Okay.
Okay. We have now coffee break. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.